So what is this? Okay. So I'm a senior research associate at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics, and for the past 8 years, I've been a member of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, engaged in the search for gravitational waves from the LIGO GEO-600 and Virgo gravitational wave antennas. There's some jargon on that slide already, so please bear with me. I will get to explaining what all of that is. I think most people in the audience actually do know what I'm talking about, but it's always good to just make sure everyone's covered. So I'm going to talk about what gravitational waves are and what gravitational wave astronomy is, and what some of the challenges are in searching for gravitational waves, in particular from cosmic strings, which is a search effort I've been involved in, and also the collisions of compact objects, which is the other thing I've been doing. And the effort to try to search for evidence of these signal of these objects in the data from the LIGO and Virgo antennas has resulted in some, I guess, what I'd call fun fallout. And I'm going to talk about some of that. So of course, this is an enormous project, and I have lots of people I work with, in particular Chad Hanna, who's right here at Perimeter, and Drew Keppel are the people I've been working with most closely. Drew's at the Albert Einstein Institute in Hanover, and Florent Robinet at the Laboratoire de l'Accélérateur Linéaire in Marseille. This is one of these acronyms that you can do in English too, right, because it's the Linear Accelerator Laboratory. Okay, so I promised a bit of background. I'll go through this fairly quickly, though. What is gravity? Well, in 1916 and 1918, Einstein published what we call today the general theory of relativity. This is now the leading contender for the explanation of the phenomenon of gravity. And it explains gravity as a curvature of space and time. The idea is that the sources of gravity, so masses and pressures and so on, bend space-time, and objects traveling in time attempt to follow straight-line geodesics through this curved structure. And the resulting motion in three dimensions is what we perceive as the phenomenon as gravity. What is a gravitational wave? Well, if you consider Maxwell's equations, right, on the left-hand side you have second spatial derivatives, and on the right-hand side you have some source terms for the electric and magnetic fields. So here's the electric charge and the magnetic current. As you know from undergrad, you can use some vector calculus identities and combine some of these to show that in a vacuum, the electric field vector satisfies an equation of this form. The magnetic field vector does as well, which is a wave equation, and it predicts a certain speed for the waves. So what this means is if you could set up an electric field by placing some charges and then wiggle those charges around to produce a time-varying electric field, you should be able to radiate a wave that carries energy away from the system, just as you see in the surface of water and so on. Of course, we know that that's true. The same prediction can be made from Einstein's field equation. So this is the extremely compact way of writing the equivalent of Maxwell's equations for Einstein gravity. So the left-hand side, you have spatial derivatives, second-order spatial derivatives of the metric of the space-time. And on the right-hand side, you have the sources, the stresses and energy densities in space-time. If you take a weak field limit of this, so you assume small perturbations to the geometry of space-time, you can show that those perturbations in a vacuum satisfy a wave equation. So the implication is the same, that if you could create a curvature in space-time and then jiggle the charges around that have produced that curvature, that curvature should radiate away from the charges and carry energy away from the system. So for example, here, if you have a pair of black holes in an orbit around one another, there's this little cartoon depiction of space-time curvature around the black holes, and as they orbit, this produces this sort of spiral outward gravitational wave. So you should be able to detect a gravitational wave that with anything that's sensitive to a change in the geometry of space. So the geometry of space is literally the physical distances between things. So anything that's sensitive to the changes in lengths in its environment should be able to respond to a gravitational wave. So for example, a tuning fork should work. You've got a pair of metal tines, and as a gravitational wave passes between them, the distance between those tines appears to increase or decrease. But the mechanical rigidity of the material wants those atoms to have some spacing between them, so it tends to restore them. And so the passage of a gravitational wave should induce ringing in a tuning fork. Here's a picture of Joseph Weber. He's one of the pioneers in the field of gravitational wave astronomy, working on what is essentially a giant tuning fork, except it doesn't look like a pair of tines. It's a solid rod of aluminum. You can see it's enormous. It's hanging on a little cable here, so it's not trying to touch as little of its environment as possible. And there's strain gauges wrapped around its waist. The idea is if a gravitational wave passes through this, the ends of the bar appear to have the wrong length or wrong separation between them, and the electromagnetic forces between the aluminum atoms try to restore it and induce it to start ringing. These bars then, you would tune them to have frequencies at interesting gravitational wave frequencies. His efforts to search for gravitational waves with these things were unsuccessful. But there are other ideas. For example, a laser interferometer should also work. If you have a laser, for example, in a Michelson interferometer configuration where you have a beam splitter that sends half of the light down two orthogonal arms where they bounce off mirrors at the end of the arms in return, the phase relationship between the returning beams determines which of these two directions the light will go when it gets to the beam splitter. So as a gravitational wave passes through this system and appears to change the distance between the test mass and the beam splitter, you get a perturbation in the phase relationship between these things and a variation in the brightness of the beam at the output. Okay, so what do we hope to learn from gravitational wave astronomy, or what is gravitational wave astronomy? And I think it's useful to think a little bit about electromagnetic astronomy when considering this. When you observe an electromagnetic wave from some object distant from Earth, the only information that's really carried by that wave is how the charges were moving in that object. So how the electric charges and the currents were varying in time. All the other things that you associate with observations in astronomy, so for example, the material conclusions about the material composition of stars or their distance from us and so on, is not information that's carried by the electromagnetic field itself, but it's something we have to infer from the electromagnetic field based on other experiments that we do here on Earth. For example, if you study the properties of gases here on Earth, you discover that when atoms are jostled around, they tend to produce photons with certain discrete frequencies that result from the electrons in the atoms having discrete energy levels that they're allowed to occupy. So you can construct a catalog of spectra from various atoms, and then if you collect light from some object out in space and you observe lines like this in it, if you then make the assumption that the laws of physics at that object are the same as the laws of physics in your laboratory, you can conclude things about the composition of that object. You can decide, well, it has the same things, the same kinds of atoms in it as I had in my gas tube. Of course, if you see these lines at the wrong frequencies, you might find that if you assume a Doppler shift, that you can get them to be fixed. And so again, all of this is coming from correlating the observations with other experiments that you do locally. And gravitational wave astronomy is going to be the same sort of a process. The only immediate information carried by the gravitational wave is going to be information about how the charges that produced it were moving. What that means about the source of those waves is going to have to come from other information that we derive locally from experiments in labs. Now, we can't make gravitational waves of sufficient amplitude in the laboratory to be detected. So the kinds of experiments I'm talking about are theoretical ones, numerical simulations in computers or analytic calculations on paper. The brightest sources of gravitational waves will be objects that have very strong gravity and are accelerating greatly. So for example, colliding black holes.
Sorry. Just so I get a sense of scale, how large accelerations we're talking about?
Towards the end of the evolution, C. I mean, they'll be going at C at hundreds of hertz, so the accelerations are very, very high. Yeah. So what do we hope to learn from this endeavor? Fine, we see gravitational waves, we infer things about the objects. What kinds of things might we be able to learn? Well, I think the holy grail is is information about whether or not general relativity is the correct theory of gravity. But along the way, we'll learn a lot about the objects that are producing the gravitational waves. So for example, we'll learn what masses were present in the system, how much rotational energy they, how much spin they carried, and so on. We might learn about their equation of state. We might learn about the stiffness of nuclear matter in neutron stars. We should fairly easily figure out how far away they are. One of the interesting things about gravitational wave sources is they tend to have very few degrees of freedom, and the amplitude of the waves that are emitted are set exactly by the masses that were present in the system. And so by just observing the amplitude of the wave that you see here on Earth, you can infer very precisely how far away the object was with no distance ladder or anything. We can hopefully learn about the evolution of stars. One of the open questions is, what is the most massive star possible? Can you have a 500 solar mass star? Are there 500 solar mass black holes in the universe? Identifying bursts from cosmic strings, if we ever do that, could teach us about phase transitions in the early universe. So if it's so wonderful, why don't we do it? Well, it's hard. Really, the biggest impediment to making progress in this field is that gravitational waves are extremely weak. And I've got some numbers here just to put a scale on this. So for example, if you have a pair of 1.4 solar mass neutron stars, these are gravitationally collapsed remnants of large massive stars. The electrons have been pushed into the nuclei and they've merged with the protons. So you've got balls that are just neutrons for the most part at nuclear densities. So an object this massive will fit into a sphere about 10 kilometers across, which means you can have these two objects approach each other very closely. So for example, if their orbital separation is just 50 kilometers, in this configuration, the orbital frequency is 275 hertz. If you were in a spaceship near this system, you would not be able to perceive these stars as distinct objects, right? You'd have these two 10 kilometer balls 50 kilometers apart, but going around at 275 hertz. So your eyes would just perceive this as this kind of blurry torus thing that seems to be shrinking fairly quickly as the pair of them radiate gravitational binding energy as gravitational radiation. The rate at which that system is losing orbital energy to gravitational waves in this configuration is 10 to the 46 watts. And for comparison, the total power output of our sun is 10 to the 26.5 watts. So this is for a brief period of time, and the system should survive for about a quarter second, like from this point to when the two objects merge and suck themselves into a black hole. So for about a quarter second or maybe a half second, this system outshines all of the stars in the visible universe, but in gravitational radiation, not visible radiation. If a system like this was 17 million parsecs away in the Virgo galaxy cluster, the flux density of Earth would be a fifth of a watt per square meter, which is really an insane amount of power in astronomical terms. But the perturbation in the geometry of space this produces, so this change in distance that's observed, occurs in the 21st decimal place. So this is strain, this is the change in distance per distance, which is how the amplitude of gravitational waves is quantified. And so this system would, at Earth, have a strain like this. So you're looking for changes in the distances between the mirror and the beam splitter in the 21st decimal place. So this, you've heard this analogy that gravity is like a rubber sheet, right? You put a ball like a star into this rubber sheet and it bends it, and then, planets and so on are kind of rolling around in the pit that's formed. That's a reasonable analogy, except that trampoline is very, very stiff. It takes an enormous energy density to produce even tiny, tiny fluctuations in its shape. What is LIGO? This was something I mentioned on the first few slides. This is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. This is an effort funded by the National Science Foundation in the United States to search for gravitational waves and hopefully create the field of gravitational wave astronomy. It consists of three instruments. Two of them are located in the United States, one in Hanford, Washington. This is in the southeastern corner of the state, and Livingston, Louisiana, which is halfway between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. you can tell the two apart. They're exact copies of each other, except one is in a desert and one is in a forest. So you can always tell them apart in aerial photos. There is a third interferometer, which was going to be co-located at Hanford. It was going to share a vacuum envelope with the other one. But it is now going to be built in India and either be called LIGO India or INDIGO, which is, I think, one of the best gravitational wave observatory acronyms. So this is, the components are being donated by the National Science Foundation. They have a total value of about $70 million. The Indians are going to build the facility and operate it, which is the bulk of the cost. So anything that moves the mirrors will be mistaken for a gravitational wave. And you can imagine that things might move the mirrors on those sorts of scales at 1 part in 10 to the 21. And here's a cartoon of some of the sources. I got this from Rana Adhikari, who was visiting here just a couple of weeks ago, and some of you might recognize this cartoon. So, of course, seismic vibrations are one source of noise that moves the mirrors. This interferometer is in a commercial forest. These patches are where the trees have been logged, so that's a major source of noise. At the end of this arm, it's sort of hard to see. If you know what to look for, you can see there's kind of a line through the trees. That's a rail line, and trains go back and forth along that. It's actually a CN rail line, so it's the Canadians who are wrecking the the sensitivity of this interferometer. This area has started to see fracking activity, so now people are detonating these enormous explosive charges deep underground. So all of that's wonderful. The laser flux on the mirror is very high. Advanced LIGO, the laser power might be as high as a megawatt on the end test mass. And as you know, unlike the predictions of Maxwell's equations, lasers are actually composed of discrete particles called photons. So the reflection of the beam off the end test mass occurs through a series of discrete collisions with an exchange of momentum. And that is kind of like this rain or hammering on this mirror that causes it to undergo Brownian motion. So radiation pressure is one source of noise. And at the photodetector, again, the laser field is quantized. So this photodetector can measure 3 photons or 4 photons. It can't ever see 3.5 photons. So there's a Poisson counting fluctuation noise coming in at the photodetector, all of which comes together to produce a noise spectrum that looks like this. On the horizontal axis is frequency in hertz. And you can see that this is sort of the range of human hearing. This is 100 hertz to a kilohertz to a few kilohertz. The y-axis is the square root of the spectral density of the noise. So if you square this, what you get is a quantity whose integral gives you the variance of the time series data that comes out of the interferometer. And so, for example, if you imagine you only cared about some range of frequencies, then you could integrate over that and see how much, you know, time series variation is present in that part of the data. So at low frequencies, the noise is dominated by seismic noise. And at high frequencies, it's dominated by the counting fluctuations at the photodiode. And those basically set those limit the passband. There are a bunch of other phenomena that contribute a bit in the middle. So for example, the thermal noise in the mirrors is in here as well. And then there's scattered light off residual gas in the beam tubes and so on. So as you probably are aware, LIGO has been operating for a while and is currently in the process of being upgraded to a new interferometer, a new pair of interferometers called Advanced LIGO. And this is a plot that shows the current status of this effort. The money came available in late 2007. The initial LIGO interferometers continued to operate through until 2010. So this period of time was the initial construction, so components were being assembled and stored in warehouses. You can see the budget in blue and the actual expenditures in red. So the Advanced LIGO project has consistently been several million dollars under budget, sometimes as much as $10 or $15 million below budget. This was helped by the global economic collapse in 2009, which reduced the demand for energy, so the price of crude oil dropped, and the cost of stainless steel is essentially determined entirely by the cost of the energy to liquefy the material. So LIGO put its orders in for stainless steel at this time, and that kept it significantly under budget. Of course, now we're hearing about the sequester in the United States, so it's good to know that that's actually not going to impact the science of advanced LIGO. It's being absorbed by scaling back non-critical components of the project. So, for example, the LIGO Open Science Center, I just realized I've got this. It should be the American spelling. That was a facility that was going to make the LIGO data publicly available. And so several million dollars had been allocated to that to pay for the people to run the system and pay for the internet bandwidth and the hardware to do that. So that's been significantly scaled back. Also, there was always a contingency fund in the budget to pay for unexpected accidents and so on. And so it's been decided the sequester is one of those unexpected things, and the contingency funds are being absorbed or consumed to pay for the finished construction of advanced LIGO. But you can see where we are. This was as of March, so this line has moved over a little bit. And the rate of expenditure has really leveled off. Basically, everything's bought and paid for, and it's just being screwed together now at the interferometers. This step function at the end is the purchase of the computers, which is being put off until the very last moment to make the most benefit from Moore's law. So that step function essentially indicates the completion of advanced LIGO. At that point, we start doing astronomy with them.
So the cost on the graph, is that per year or is that total?
It's total.
Total.
Yeah, so it's just the upgrade, right? So the it goes up to 200 million. The facilities were paid for as part of initial LIGO, and they cost about that much to build. So the total cost is a little less than a billion from you know, the breaking ground for initial LIGO to the complete installation of advanced LIGO. Yeah. Of course, you know, what's interesting about that is to consider what it would cost if you sort of short-circuited the process, right? If you didn't build initial LIGO and you just went straight to this interferometer, you know, could you have done it for 200 million less, 300 million less? Anyway, if it was to be done again, it might be quite a bit cheaper. So what happens in 2015? Will advanced LIGO just be ready to go? Well, probably not. This is a projected sequence of sensitivity curves. The black one is the one I showed earlier. This is the sort of final so-called design noise curve, although people don't like calling it the design noise curve, because if you don't meet the design noise curve, then you have failed somehow. So it's just projected sensitivity for late advanced LIGO. And you can see the date there. The expectation is that it probably will not be achieved for several more years. What should be possible in 2015 is something more like this blue curve. And this range of sensitivities sort of translates into this range for binary neutron stars. So we should be able to see a detectable binary neutron star merger at 40 to 80 megaparsecs. Initial LIGO achieved something like 20 megaparsecs, 25 megaparsecs towards the end of its operation. Some parts of this curve, or some of the ways in which this curve differs from late advanced LIGO, are dictated by the laws of physics. For example, the early A LIGO will not be operating with the laser at full power. It'll be down by an order of magnitude. So that explains this increase in the counting fluctuations at the photodetector. Down here, however, there's actually no reason why the final curve should not be achieved. This curve, this part of the curve, is limited by seismic noise. And that's removed from the interferometer by the seismic isolation system, which has been built and installed. And either it works or it doesn't work. If it works, then this curve could look more like the black curve at low frequencies. So what's happened here is the people doing the instrument installation are really just covering their behinds by saying, well, look, we know that the first time probably things won't work. We don't know why exactly, but we should expect that. So they've just added an order of magnitude of 1 over F noise to the noise curve. Of course, I'm hopeful that things will work out better than this and that we'll get really lucky. And in in these early science runs, the range will be, you know, at the high end of this, and maybe even more, maybe even 90. Maybe it'll look more like this green curve. Well, of course, not at high frequencies.
What's the difference between the one on the left and the one on the right?
Oh, sorry. This is, it's probably hard to read. This is Virgo. So this is the Italian-French interferometer near Pisa, Italy. It has a different optical configuration. So it's the progress of its sensitivity is different. Although the final noise curve looks very similar to Advanced LIGO. There's just sort of the thing you can achieve with modern technology, and all attempts end up with something very similar. This purple one involves a change in the optical configuration of the interferometer to basically trade noise at high frequency for sensitivity at these intermediate frequencies. And the idea is to do this to search specifically for physics in the mergers of binary neutron stars. So get the noise down in this sort of several hundred hertz regime to see if we can maybe learn more about the dynamics of the stars as they rip apart and merge. But it will hurt high frequency searches. So for example, supernovae and things like that. Okay, now I'm going to talk about the search for cosmic strings. This is something I've been involved in for several years, initially with Javi Siemens at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who's, I think, visited a bunch of times and given talks about this. So probably some people in the audience are familiar with this, but probably also many people aren't. So cosmic strings are hypothetical, thin, line-like concentrations of energy. They are a generic prediction of field theories, the result of phase transitions in the early universe, settling the universe into different ground states in different regions, and then as those regions come into causal contact and the gradients of those ground states cause them to try to come to a common ground state, you can end up with these sort of defects left behind where, you know, if the field theory has the right potential, you can end up with this kind of unresolvable defect in the energy density that results in this sort of all of the energy associated with the gradients in the ground state being concentrated into this line that gets stuck. They're very long. They stretch from one side of the universe to the other. You know, as a result of this origin mechanism. Oops. And there was a time when a network of cosmic strings was a contender for the source of the anisotropy that seeded galaxy condensation, although CMB observations now reject that hypothesis. Nevertheless, they can't rule out the presence of a small number of these objects in the universe. Really, the question is whether, you know, late inflation diluted them out or whether there's still some left in our universe that we can see. So if two of them meet, they can collide and reconnect. So rather than having two straight strings moving through space, you end up with two strings with a cusp, a little corner on them. And that corner represents an energy penalty for the string, so it tries to get rid of it. It tries to sort of straighten itself out. And that happens through this sort of unwinding process where the string flicks this cusp, and the mass in that cusp can be boosted to nearly the speed of light. So you get this very intense sort of blast of gravitational radiation in the direction of the sort of cracking of that whip. And it produces a waveform that looks like this. Now, this dip in it is non-physical. This is just a result of me having put a high-pass filter at 1 hertz in the code that generated this so that it would be periodic on this interval. you can see from the previous slides that's well outside of the LIGO band. So this non-physical dip is of course, completely invisible to LIGO. But you get this sort of spiky pulse of gravitational strain. The top of that spike is rolled over. There's a high-frequency cutoff to this, which is determined by the angle between the line of sight to Earth and the direction the burst was radiated in. So if we were looking straight down the bore site of the flash, this would be a very, very pointy structure, and the more off-axis you get, the more rounded off you get. So you lose the high-frequency components of the wave. So we're looking for these things in the data. Of course, you can imagine that some of those noise sources I mentioned will produce little clicks and pops in the data that look just like this. So how do we tell the difference between the noise and a real gravitational wave. Well, this is where it all starts. This is Bayes' theorem. On the left-hand side is what we want to know. We want to know, so if we assume we have some technique by which we can identify interesting things in the data, little features in the data that look like the thing we're looking for, what we want to know is, with what probability is that thing a gravitational wave, given whatever it is we know about it. So for example, we might know the time at which it occurred, we might know the amplitude at which it's present in the data, we might know some other things. We might know whether some other instrument also saw something at the same time. These are examples of the kinds of things that might go into this list of things we know about the event. Bayes' theorem lets us rewrite this like this. So this is the probability that something we know to be a gravitational wave produces those observed properties, times the probability that some event chosen at random is a gravitational wave, divided by the probability that an event chosen at random is found to have those kinds of those properties. Evaluating the right-hand side is something that we can't actually do. For example, we don't know that this is not identically zero. If we could prove to someone that the probability of picking an event at random and finding it to be a gravitational wave was not identically zero, then we would have proven we have built an instrument that can detect gravitational waves and there is a flux of detectable gravitational waves passing through it. We don't know that. We can't prove that to people. So there are things over here that we just can't evaluate. But we can still make progress. We know that everything in the data belongs to one of two categories. It either is a gravitational wave or it is not a gravitational wave. There is no third possibility. So those two probabilities are related by this identity, and you can use that to show that the right-hand side is a monotonically increasing function of this ratio, the likelihood ratio. So in the numerator, we have the probability that something we know to be a gravitational wave would produce the observed properties of our candidate event, divided by the probability that an event we know to not be a gravitational wave produces those same properties. So this lets us rank the events from worst to best. We don't know, what we've lost is the ability to say with what probability any of them actually is a gravitational wave, but we can pick the best one out of the list. And then we can go from there. This is something we now can measure. So for example, we can put synthetic events in the data. We can hide fake gravitational waves, run the data through our pipeline, and just histogram what comes out the other end. So we can measure this distribution. And for the denominator, what we can do is assume that we're in the low event rate limit, assume that most of the stuff coming out of the pipeline is noise, that we're completely dominated by noise, and just basically histogram up the properties of everything that comes out of the pipeline. There might be a few genuine gravitational waves in there, but the assumption is that they're so small, so few in number, that they will not substantially contaminate this measured probability density. Now, it turns out if you know the source of events that are not gravitational waves is a stationary Gaussian process, then you can show that this likelihood ratio is a monotonically increasing function of, now I'm not going to bother explaining this, this is the matched filter signal-to-noise ratio. I'll go through some of the symbols, but there's a lot of nonsense here that's not worth paying attention to. Here you have the Fourier transform of the waveform you're looking for. This is the Fourier transform of the data. So you multiply them together, you essentially take an inner product in the Fourier domain, but you weight each frequency bin by the strain spectral density. So this, the denominator is that noise curve that I showed you. So frequency bins that are contaminated with lots of noise are given a very low weighting, and frequency bins that have very little noise are, you know, dominate this inner product. So the advantage of doing this is it can be computed extremely fast, extremely quickly. This frequency domain inner product can be evaluated over and over and over again for different samples of the data using FFT convolution. So it's an extremely computationally efficient way of finding events. But it does rely on this assumption that the noise is stationary and Gaussian. The more this assumption fails to hold, the less optimum this ranking is going to be for the events. And this is how that works. Here we've got, you know, one of those string cusp waveforms, again, embedded in stationary Gaussian noise. And the y-axis, I don't know if people at the back can see it, but the y-axis is in units of the standard deviation of this noise. So 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this peak here is a 5 sigma departure from the mean value of this time series. So for example, if you put a threshold here at 3, you know, that would find this peak, but these fluctuations will cross it with a probability of about 1 in 1,000. So you'll have, you know, some false alarms at that rate. If you take your template waveform, so you take a copy of this thing that's in the data, and you do this business of computing this sliding inner product, and you move it along, the result of that is a function of this sort of shift. It looks like this. These little wiggles are what's left of this noise, and this low frequency oscillation is the autocorrelation function of the template. So this low frequency variation is not noise, that's actually the signal you're looking for. And it gets up to now 10, and again, this is in units of the standard deviation of this little wiggly line. So what was once a 5 sigma departure from the noise is now a 10 sigma departure from the noise. So this process of match filtering has separated the signals you're looking for from the background noise and made it easier to find them. So Javi and I ran a search in the initial LIGO data from the fourth science run that relied essentially entirely on that technique. So we collected data from the interferometers, we ran them through match filters for string cusp waveforms, thresholded on the signal-to-noise ratio, and then applied a three-way time coincidence. So we required all three instruments to have seen something at the same time. Also, in initial LIGO, we had the two Hanford interferometers. So because they are co-located, they have the same beam pattern, they should see exactly the same gravitational waves. So we also demanded that there was an amplitude consistency between those two interferometers. And the result was a list of the things seen in the Hanford data, just ranked by that signal-to-noise ratio. But with the other instruments having been used as cuts, basically, to weed out noise events.
How much did that threefold coincidence? What percentage of high signal noise events in one detector were cut up?
I think each additional instrument knocks it down by two orders of magnitude. I think that's the number that comes to the tip of my tongue. Yeah. I think that's right.
Almost all of the big blips are.
Yeah. Well, that's the idea. This SNR, of course, there are enormous departures from the noise. The noise turns out to not be Gaussian and stationary. Yeah, so we really do rely on this other stuff. It's really this that saves you at all. The highest SNR observed in initial LIGO was NAN. Literally, the data was uncalibratable. It was so, it exceeded floating point. It was kind of nuts.
And is that even true of the two detectors that were both at Hanford?
They do help. They're co-located, but they're different lengths. So the one was 4 kilometers, and one was 2 kilometers. So the beam splitters were physically within just a few meters of each other, but the end test masses were 2 kilometers apart. And seismic noise is sort of the main culprit in all of this. And so you're waiting for something to travel through the rock underground, and it takes tens of seconds actually to go that far, or is it 4 seconds? It travels at about 100 miles an hour in rocks. It's the seismic waves. So that's a long time in sort of light travel time units. So demanding coincidence between those two interferometers on sort of milliseconds meant that you got rid of most of the seismic noise, except stuff that affected the corner station, because then it was common to both. That gets eliminated by this, because the seismic noise at the corner station physically displaces the beam splitters sort of by similar distances, but how that is interpreted as a strain differs by a factor of 2 in the two instruments, because that represents a twice as large a change in the length of the arms for the shorter interferometer. So this was good at eliminating seismic noise at the corner station. And these are the results of the search. Okay, so the there are four panels here, one for each of four choices of this reconnection probability. So normal field theoretic strings in three dimensions of space always hit each other when they encounter one another. So this is a 100% reconnection probability. If they are strings in more dimensions, then they can miss each other in those other dimensions, even though they hit each other in the three of regular space. What happens then is a network can survive longer and not radiate its energy. So it can survive to later times and increase the flux of bursts that we see here at Earth. So we're better able to constrain that theory. So on the x-axis here is the linear mass density of the string. The y-axis is this kind of mystery parameter that includes all sorts of stuff about the string network. So the fluctuation of perturbations on the string, the number density of them in the early universe, and so on. It's essentially a parameter that encodes the spectrum of fluctuations on the string and all of the things that might affect it. And we, the null result, we of course did not detect gravitational waves, and that meant we could exclude cosmic string networks in the, you know, to the lower right of this red curve. Now, what are these other curves? This one here, so this is LIGO's fourth science run. This curve here is what we should have been able to exclude things to the right of had we executed an ideal pipeline using an instrument that had ideal stationary Gaussian noise. So if you take the predicted noise curve of the initial LIGO interferometers and you assume you have ideal stationary Gaussian noise with that spectrum and you run a perfect pipeline on it, you should be able to achieve this sensitivity. So a null result would have been interpreted as there being nothing to the right of this. The fact that this red line is to the right of that is a consequence of the data not being ideal and the pipeline analyzing it not being ideal as well. This uncertainty is mostly a 10% calibration uncertainty in the interferometer. So we don't know, we can't constrain amplitudes to better than 10%. So that was the fourth science run. Now, what have we done to make things better? So this is the result of work that I did. I didn't put the archive number on this slide. It's on the next one. Nope. Here. So you can look up the motivation here. There's a derivation for what's going on. So in the fifth and sixth science runs of LIGO, we had a fourth interferometer, Virgo. Now, this business of demanding full n-way coincidence means that you can't search for gravitational waves unless all of your interferometers are on at the same time. And they don't stay on all the time. Noise knocks them out of lock or stops the laser from resonating in the cavities and they have to be gotten working again. Each interferometer has about an 85% duty cycle. So demanding three-way coincidence already gets you down to a net duty cycle of about 50%. A fourth interferometer means that nearly 60% of the time, you're just not even looking at the data if you were demanding four-way coincidence. So we needed a way to address that. We needed a pipeline that could sort of naturally accommodate different combinations of instruments. We also wanted to make use of all of this other information that we were throwing away from the other interferometers. All we were really keeping was the fact that something had been seen, not what it was. What was the amplitude? You know, were things coincident? So here's how this works. So we still do a match filter, which is really just intended to find things that are interesting in the data. It's no longer the principal ranking statistic for the events. We still do a time coincidence, but it's a loose coincidence. It's not intended to exclude all the noise. It's just, again, meant to sort of find things that are interesting to subject to further analysis. What we do with each of these sort of tuples of events then, well, we record them to disk, but we also run them through this kind of parameter extraction code that measures things about them. So for example, it measures the time difference between the two Hanford instruments and the amplitude ratio of the Virgo and Livingston instruments and so on. And it histograms it all up. So this is coming back to that likelihood ratio I was talking about earlier. Here's an example of one of the histograms that comes out of it. This red curve is the probability density. Okay, so on the x-axis, we have the log base 10 of the ratio of the amplitude of an event found in Hanford to the amplitude seen in Livingston. So at 0 means these amplitudes are the same, and to the right, Hanford saw the event at a higher amplitude, and to the left, Livingston saw it at a higher amplitude. The red is the probability density we observe in simulated signals that we hide in the data. And the black is what we find from the noise events, everything else. So you can see these two parameters. This parameter is not particularly informative, right? These two curves, like, you couldn't threshold on this. You couldn't put a cut somewhere and say, okay, everything in this range is going to be good and everything outside is bad. But that doesn't mean it's useless, right? There are ranges of parameters that favor the noise hypothesis and other ranges that favor the signal hypothesis. So there's information here. It's just not as simple as a cut that you can use. So once we've got all these histograms, we then go back to our list of events, pull out the parameters from each tuple of candidates one by one, and evaluate, basically plot them on these histograms, and just pull out the numerator and denominators of the likelihood ratio and rank them this way. And, well, here's a bit of a laundry list of some of the improvements that we made. I won't go through them because I'm kind of running out of time. But the punchline is we achieved a factor of 2 to 3 improvement in this range sensitivity by doing this. And by allowing non-full way coincidence, we were able to double the usable observation time in the network of instruments as well. When you put all that together, you have 1.5 orders of magnitude increase in the volume of space that you can observe and the length of time for which you watch it for events. So this is a 30-fold increase in detectable event rate, which is this increase in strain sensitivity alone is as much as was achieved by the $2 million upgrade to the enhanced LIGO configuration. So the point here is that gravitational wave data analysis is not a solved problem, and by putting effort into thinking about new ways to search for the events, you can have a significant impact on the sensitivity of the searches, certainly as much as extremely expensive hardware upgrades. And opportunities for this exist in other pipelines as well. So here, yeah.
So you're talking about this in the context of a cosmic string.
Yeah.
How much of that increase is exportable to other sources? I mean, is that a generic kind of increase, or is that just...
For the binary neutron star search, it probably is not as exportable because the waveforms are so long that even very simple tests can tell the difference between them and glitches. But for binary black holes, shorter waveforms, yeah, currently this will improve those searches significantly. It should be, yeah, 2 to 3 sensitivity, yeah. So I reran the analysis, the new pipeline on the old data, and this is now where this exclusion plug goes to. This is assuming a null result. Now, I should admit, I did not check to see whether it detected something or not. That doesn't matter, because, of course, we're analyzing the newer data. But you can see how close this pipeline now is to this ideal curve. And this ideal curve is not computed with the actual noise spectrum. It was with the design noise spectrum, which initial LIGO failed to achieve exactly. It achieved it across most of the band, but in particular at low frequencies, there was a lot more noise than expected. So the fact that we got so close to this kind of ideal mathematical bound is, I think, you know, searching for these things that just look like clicks, is, I think, really quite remarkable. Now I'm going to quickly talk about the search for compact object mergers, and I am running late, so I think I'm going to skip ahead a bit, and I apologize for that. But we, you know, as I showed on an earlier slide, if you have a pair of black holes or neutron stars in an orbit around each other, if the orbit is really tight, they'll be radiating gravitational waves at a rate high enough to get them to merge within the lifetime of the universe. And the waveform that you get from the system looks like this. So it's these sinusoidal oscillations that correspond to the objects going around in their orbits. And as the orbit shrinks, the orbital frequency increases and the strength of the gravitational field increases. So the amplitude of the gravitational waves coming out goes up. So you end up with this evolution that looks like this. The frequency is going up and up and up and up and up, and the amplitude is going up and up and up until finally they collide, and you're maybe left with a black hole that's kind of perturbed, and then that rings down, becomes spherical, and you're left with nothing at the end, no signal anymore. Okay, so these waveforms, you know, they sort of evolve over time. So you have this sort of interpretation that they sweep through the LIGO band, right? They start out at low frequencies. They become visible as the system shrinks and the orbital frequency gets up towards detectable. And depending on the mass of the system or how high a frequency you can get up to, the merger might be buried in the shot noise, or it might be visible in the middle of the band. And this range of masses, so if the total system mass is less than about 30 solar masses, the merger will occur at a high enough frequency that it's not visible. So all we can really see is this sort of in spiral. Now the upgrade to advanced LIGO is going to have the following implications for the search for these waveforms. So initial LIGO, the seismic noise, really sort of kicked in at around 40 hertz. So we were unable to observe waveforms below that frequency. For advanced LIGO, we hope that this will be as low as 10 hertz. Now that doesn't look like a big difference. It's only a factor of 4, it's only just 30 hertz. But these systems spend a lot of time at those low frequencies because of, you know, they're not radiating a lot of energy, so they evolve very slowly. And that means that a 1-1 solar mass binary system would have spent 45 seconds visible in the initial LIGO band. It now spends half an hour, or it will spend half an hour in the advanced LIGO band. Because you can observe the waveform for longer, your ability to resolve small changes in the orbital frequency improves. So you need to tile the parameter space with more templates. And the number of them increases in that low mass regime where the merger is not visible from about 10,000 templates now to a million in advanced LIGO. So we've gone from 10,000 45-second templates to a million half-hour templates. This is a nearly intractable computational problem. So you need tricks. One trick is you can split the waveform up. So this match filtering is a linear transform on the data, which means you can slice a waveform up and do the filtering on the bits and then add the results together later. You can just exchange the operations of adding and filtering. And this, the low frequency bits can be stored in memory at a lower sample rate because they evolve more slowly. And the high frequency bits require more samples. Of course, this is where the system spends almost all of its time. So slice this time domain division of the waveform achieves an enormous reduction in the space required to store the waveforms. The next trick you can use is something to address the number of the templates. So algebraically, this is what the matched filter template bank looks like, right? We have a column vector of h of t, and we have a matrix whose rows are the waveforms we're searching for. And these waveforms are one by one interproducted with h of t to give one sample of SNR. Right? The strain data is then shifted over by one sample, and we take this matrix vector product again, and we get another vector of samples of signal-to-noise ratio for the templates. Okay, so we've got this matrix that we're multiplying by this vector over and over and over again. But the rows in this matrix all kind of look the same. In fact, that's by construction, because we don't want to miss any signals. So these templates have been deliberately constructed to be nearly perfect matches for each other. In fact, they differ from each other only in the second decimal place. So what we can do is factor this matrix and write it as the product of two matrices, one of which has a much lower rank than this matrix. We can do that using a singular value decomposition. And this is work that I've been involved in with Chad Hannan and Drew Keppel. And you can see some descriptions of that here. Now this, of course, as I said, was initially motivated simply by the desire to make use of actual physical computers to do this search, not imaginary computers. So there was no grand desire to make progress in the analysis of waveforms. It was just to make things fit onto the computers. But it has opened up all kinds of interesting avenues of research. One is the possibility that we can generalize these searches to look for waveforms that aren't quite exactly one of the templates. You know, we can imagine taking linear combinations of the basis functions that we've written them as that are not necessarily one of the linear combinations we were searching for. So for example, if you take, you know, your data, and these are the templates, this is a graphical representation. Imagine the space of all possible waveforms had just three dimensions. The templates all look like inspirals. They don't look like any arbitrary random waveform. So you imagine that they're confined to some hypersurface in this space. The data is just some random vector. And what we're interested in is, does this vector contain a component that looks like something in this family of waveforms? If we know that we can express all of these as a linear combination of the x and y unit vectors, then simply projecting this onto the xy plane and taking its magnitude tells us the amount by which this vector contains something that looks like that family. But it will also pick up waveforms that are out here, you know, that are not necessarily one of our templates. Now, some of them will be completely non-physical, but some of them might kind of look like, you know, waveforms that correspond to maybe departures from GR a little bit, or maybe waveforms from systems that had significant spin in them. You know, some way in which these waveforms aren't quite right could potentially be picked up this way. And one of the really fun things that's come out of this, so here's what the projections look like. If you take these template waveforms and project them onto that basis, you end up with things that look like this. So here is the first panel. So the x-axis is the total mass of the system, and the y-axis is the mass ratio of the pair. And this shows the real component of the projection of all the templates sort of in this range of masses onto the first basis vector. And this is the projection of those same waveforms onto the 13th basis vector. Now you look at those and you say, those are really smooth functions. In fact, there's very little structure in them at all. This looks kind of like just a bunch of Fourier modes. You know, maybe I can just find a way to describe these functions and write in spiral waveforms that way. So rather than describing them in terms of, you know, their masses and so on, just describe them, you know, by the functional forms of these projections. So we have found that that's true. You can actually write very simple descriptions of these functions that are very good at reconstructing the waveforms. On the right, this is the projection of actual numerical relativity simulations onto the same basis. So in the x-axis is total mass, and again, the y-axis is mass ratio, but there are only simulations at a few mass ratios. In fact, there's one missing here altogether. So we can't paint in the plane as well as we can with the sort of phenomenological semi-analytic waveforms. But you can see the structures are the same. Of course, we expect that because our sort of phenomenological templates should be good matches for numerical relativity. Now the idea is, can we do the same trick? Can we do interpolation of this function to construct equivalents of numerical relativity simulations that are really accurate? And the answer is we can. Now this is a pretty busy plot, and I'm almost done. This top curve, okay, so here's total mass over sort of a range of system masses. This top curve shows the mismatch between these phenomenological templates that we use and actual numerical relativity simulations. And it's pretty good. I mean, the match is very low. We're only, you know, missing 1% of the signal-to-noise ratio. That's not a big concern. But if you take numerical relativity simulations, project them onto this basis, and then interpolate the coefficients, and then ask yourself how good a match are these interpolated waveforms for actual simulations, you end up with this curve. So we've gotten, you know, an order of magnitude improvement in some regions. So it turns out that this process provides a very accurate way of synthesizing waveforms from a small number of numerical relativity simulations. This was work I did with Harold Pfeiffer and J.D. Emberson at CETA. J.D. was a grad student who took the lead on preparing this paper, which you can find online. Okay, I'm going to skip over this and just talk a bit about the future. So I think the technology for the detection seems to be well in hand. We've got these fancy ranking statistics. But you know, there are still some open questions. You know, how much are some of these other factors that we're not currently considering important? Is spin important? Is precession and the eccentricity of waveforms? There's now some evidence that Kozai oscillations in three-body systems can drive two of the bodies in the system into a very tight orbit, but highly eccentric orbit, which could increase the rate of detections, but not from systems that are in circular orbits that are evolving in the way that we've been considering, but in eccentric orbits. And if the systems are precessing and tumbling because of spin-orbit interactions, do we need to worry about higher order modes in the gravitational wave field? So currently, we only consider the 2-2 mode of the spheroidal harmonic expansion. This is still an open question, and if we need to consider them, we don't have the mathematical framework to treat them in our pipelines properly. And some of the real, I think, open questions is what hypotheses about GR can be constrained. For example, this is some work that Luis is familiar with, this idea that neutron star mergers in scalar tensor theories could deviate from neutron star mergers in Einstein gravity in a way that's detectable in the instrument. You know, the waveforms differ at frequencies right in the middle of that bucket of sensitivity. But now the question is, do those waveforms differ in a way that just makes them look like systems with a slightly different mass? Or, how do we decide whether or not we can constrain this or not? Also, what's going on over Guelph is interesting, this idea that the tidal interactions between the black holes can identify the presence of an event horizon in the system. The event horizon looks like a body with a particular equation of state. And if we can constrain the equation of state, we can maybe say whether or not a merger contained an event horizon or not. But again, this is still an open question. Is it possible, or do the differences just mask other properties of the systems? Of course, all of this, and this is sort of one of the important messages, is none of these discoveries will be possible without looking at data. So what I hope for the future is that we can begin to form bridges between the theoretical work and the observation work now that the instruments are nearing completion and we're ready to start doing astronomy with them. And that's the end.
Question? Could you go back to your slide about your constraints on your string tension? So I was under the impression that Planck's already constrains g mu's less than 10 to the minus 7.
In some regions of this parameter. So you've got to take their results. And so we're currently working on translating their bounds into sort of this parameterization of the waveform. But it does depend on the string network that you assume, so the fluctuation of perturbations that are present. So the last time we went through this, the projection was that Planck's constraint would look like this. Right? And so we were going to just barely beat it, but they would beat us in some regions.
Okay. Yeah, because I was going to ask, are you going to be able to beat this constraint using advanced LIGO?
Yeah, we should be able to. We should beat it with initial LIGO.
Okay. How far do you think you're going to be able to get down?
Maybe we'll beat it by 10%. It will just squeak by.
Okay.
But if you assume, so this is the thing. I mean, of course, we've actually done the analysis, so I know the results. I just can't tell you yet because they're still under review. You can kind of imagine for yourself what's going to happen. If you imagine that it's a null result again, then we would put an upper limit like this. If it's not a null result, we'll have detected something, and so we're not going to exclude models. We'll have established a model. So if you assume a null result, then we'll produce an exclusion plot like this. The character of the data in the S4 analysis and the S5, S6 analyses was essentially the same. So there's really no physical reason why you should expect us to fall short of the expected sensitivity by any more or less in this. And so basically you just take this curve and assume that it'll be that many percent off this projection as well. And that's where the upper limit would be.
I have two questions. The first one is, how many template waveforms do you use when you compare your data, or when you look for the signal in your data? And the second one is, if you want to test for modified gravity theories, I would imagine that this would quickly blow up your parameter space because you need just orders of magnitude more waveforms. What is technically feasible?
Right. So for the number of templates, for the string search, the number of templates is tiny. It's like five. They're all very good matches. They only differ by how much they're rounded off at the top.
Okay.
So it's extremely cheap in search.
I was more thinking about in spirals.
Yeah. There, again, it depends on the mass range. Let's see if I've got a... Here. So in this range of masses, so this is the range of masses in which the merger is not important. All you're looking at is the in spiral phase. Initial LIGO required on the order of 10,000 templates. How many depends on the shape of this noise curve. So essentially what you're seeing is you're seeing the frequencies in this band. If the noise changes in a way that broadens this, then you need to tile the space more densely because you can sort of see more frequencies. So the number fluctuates over the course of an analysis based on the changing character of the noise, but it was typically around 10,000. For advanced LIGO, the fact that we have more sensitivity at low frequencies, or we expect more sensitivity at low frequencies, increases that substantially to 1 million for non-spinning, non-eccentric binary neutron star mergers. In this range, the number is actually very small. The waveforms, you know, when the merger is in band, the waveforms don't last as long, so they're short, which means that your frequency resolution is poorer, so you can tile the space much less densely. So in this, we're looking at thousands in initial LIGO and several tens of thousands in advanced LIGO. So this is not a computationally costly search. Also, the waveforms are short. Now for non-Einstein gravity. Let me see. This is, I think, actually the best picture. All right. I mean, geometrically, this is what's happening. It's kind of fun. There's like this, you know, we're studying general relativity, which is a geometric theory of gravity, and then you end up with this kind of meta geometry, which is the geometry of the waveform space. So here's this idea that waveforms form a vector space. Here the vector space is just three dimensions. The output of the instrument is somewhere in this space, and the things you're looking for are somewhere in this space as well. Now, when you project this vector onto this hypersurface, you pick up some length. Now, the more dimensions this hypersurface has, the more of this will be projected onto that hypersurface. So the more degrees of freedom you have in the family of waveforms you're searching for, the larger the false alarm probability. So the easier it is for noise fluctuations to result in an apparently large projection into that hypersurface. So you want to keep the dimensions of that space small, as small as possible. So you want to focus your search on exactly the kinds of waveforms you're looking for. But then you lose the ability to find things that are maybe not quite exactly what you're looking for. So there's this balancing act that has to be sort of worked on. At the present time, we actually don't have the capacity to generate templates for modified Einstein theory. So the decision is made for us. We will search for Einstein gravity up to some post-Newtonian order in the radiation reaction, and that'll be that. I think one of the things I hope to see in the future is perhaps using some of this waveform interpolation technology to construct new waveform families more easily from simulations of modified gravity theories and so on.
So am I right in thinking that if you've got, say, a black hole in scalar tensor gravity, you're not going to get a scalar charge because the black hole can't support scalar hair? So actually, if you look at waveforms coming from black hole mergers and things like that, you're not going to see any effects of modified gravity, whereas if you've got something like a neutron star, you may very well see. Is that where the differences come in?
Yeah, it might. I mean, you might find that, up to some total mass, your waveforms, you're seeing one distribution of properties, and then there's kind of a transition above some mass where now suddenly the waveforms are a better match for it. So yeah, I mean, I think now the question is, how, what is that going to be a good way to constrain this? And I don't have an answer to that question. I think that's the thing, right? There are people working on trying to find out, just kind of explore the problem space and say, what kinds of hypotheses might have observable consequences? But then, there's people such as myself who are working on how do you dig into the noise and how do you, tell the difference between these two hypotheses? And I think, together, the idea is we can make gravitational wave astronomy work.
Why is it, regarding the part where you were talking about the work with Chad, maybe just a general question is, you might think a natural thing would be to just sample the waveform, twice per oscillation, so basically every peak and trough and whatever, mm-hmm. and then do the calculate, get that inner product, weighted by the actual correlation in real time, rather than doing a frequency integral, just do a time integral. And I mean, why do you Fourier transform first and do the integral in frequency?
Formally, the Fourier transform diagonalizes the covariance matrix of the noise. And why the noise is diagonal in the frequency domain and not the time domain is probably some profound property of nature, right?
Stationary. But it's, yeah. The issue is that it would just take a lot longer to do the integral.
Oh yeah, because in the frequency domain you just have to do you just work at the diagonal components of the inner product. In the time domain you've got it all to do these 2-point things. Yeah. But it's interesting
that extra time is more, you're sure, than doing the Fourier transform.
Yeah.
It's n log n versus n squared, right?
Yeah.
N's big.
So this
FTs are F for.
Yeah, this in the time domain this is a double integral. So in the frequency domain, you get rid of one of the integrals. So because this carries with it a delta function.
Isn't that fact about it being n log n? Isn't that a fact of the fast Fourier transform if you sample it evenly spaced? That's the point. The point is you don't want to do it, right? The point is you really want the spacing to adapt. You want to get closer and closer.
Except you have to repeat this calculation over and over and over again as a function of time, right? So If you only wanted to do this inner product once, then it would be faster to just do it. But the thing is, you have to then shift over one sample and do it again and again and again. And your non-uniform sampling then is sort of destroyed.